heavenly pain.
Good morning and welcome to the Oregon Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. I'm happy to open this meeting because we're going to move through what we think are substantial suggestions, and then we'll get to the report, hopefully have agreement on the report that is the draft for the 2015 legislature. So I want to first open an informational meeting, and I'll ask for the first three individuals you see there to talk about an update from their subcommittee on financial exploitation and power of attorney concept. Fred, I'm going to ask you to lead off.
Wonderful. Thank you, Senator Gilliam. And so for the work group members, as a refresher of the power of attorney discussion, and if you recall from our last work group, there are a number of proposals to improve our infrastructure in Oregon to address financial exploitation. This was one of those proposals. We had just introduced it on looking at powers of attorney and how they're used in Oregon. And from the perspective of the Department of Human Services, I can speak for Adult Protective Services and how those forms are basically used as a vehicle for financial exploitation and fraud in too many instances. Again, a refresher, and these are from recent reports from DHS and the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations that have been released in the last couple months. There were 969 financial exploitation substantiations in 2013. 19% of those were directly related to powers of attorney and the use of powers of attorney by the agent and the perpetrator. So that would extrapolate out, and they didn't look at every single case, but it was a statistically significant study. That factors out to about 184 power of attorney related abuse substantiations in 2013 alone. In a study for 2011, the number was about 107. So you combine those 2 years, we're looking at about 400 cases over a 2-year period of power of attorney abuse, or at least financial exploitation related to powers of attorney. So what we've tried to do, and there have been a number of attempts, as I understand it, to look at power of attorney laws and statutes over many, many years here in Oregon. For our purposes, for this work group, you know, we were very much trying, and the proposal in front of you, it still is very much a working draft, but every provision in here is intended to tackle financial exploitation and to improve our infrastructure for how powers of attorney are used in Oregon to address financial exploitation. I have this vision of reducing those numbers considerably within a few years, if at all possible. But you know, doing so in a way that the power of attorney laws are still functional for all those that need to use it and that want to use power of attorney for appropriate, proper financial planning. And from a DHS perspective, that includes, for example, long-term care planning. So the, you know, the last thing I'll say, kind of additional considerations, and there were a number of considerations that went into this particular draft, you know, primarily looking at our subgroup conversations and discussions we've had over the last 5 to 6 months of the financial exploitation subgroup, reflection of efforts of 5+ years ago. Again, the efforts have been ongoing for many, many years without a ton of progress on reform and power of attorney laws. I like to believe that with the numbers that we have now from the 2011-2013 studies that we can actually put a face on the problem by doing it, you know, by having those numbers there. And then one of the final considerations was trying to create, where possible, some consistencies with our advanced directive statutes and laws. So just real quick through the sections, just to get them on the table. Section 2 of the draft, so I'll start there, that's looking at signatures. And one of the proposals is to require notarization of the principal signature, the person that's giving away the power to an agent to make financial decisions for them. I think that one in particular needs much, much more discussions, as you know, I think there's an expectation that over the next couple months there's going to be some ongoing conversations. This is not a final draft, but we're hoping it's a good workable draft for continued discussions and positive discussions. The other component within Section 2, and these are some of the biggest pieces, are requiring two witnesses, similar to advanced directives, and witness declarations that are on page 2 of the draft in subsection 3. With these witness declarations, you know, modeled after what's required in an advanced directive statutory form, I know for my part in wanting to see these declarations in statute is that they will ideally be put into forms, online forms, your FedEx office forms that are now readily available to the public. So if we're going to require witness signatures, we want the witnesses to know what it is that they're witnessing and signing for. Section 3 is some conforming language for the rest of the sections in here. Section 4 is addressing agent authority termination. Section 5 dealing with agent liability for violations. And in clarifying in particular around that agent liability, that and opening the door more for broader court-ordered restitution, that it's not just focused on the monies that might be lost to the principal, but that it might, you know, that a court would have discretion to go beyond the money that is lost, and really, seeking when possible, which is a rarity as we've had discussions, but really seeking full remedies for the principal that's been financially exploited. Section 6 is looking at, and it's an attempt, I think we're still working through this one to some degree, but again, close, I want to believe close to a final, but attempting to mandate some cooperation and requiring cooperation with other fiduciaries that are in place, either under an advanced directive, for example, but, you know, in effect creating more formalized checks and balances between fiduciaries, and in this case, power of attorney agents. Section 7. Requiring record keeping by the agent, and then providing an avenue for disclosure to certain individuals when requested. Again, very much looking at more checks and balances against that agent and their use of the power of attorney. Section 8 is establishing court processes for kind of questioning and determining the validity of the power of attorney, opening that door to court action from a third party that's questioning the agent's actions under a power of attorney. And then Section 9 is addressing the agent resignation if it's not specified in a power of attorney and who has to be notified, for example. So I went through that very fast, but just wanted to provide that quick overview and move on.
Thank you. Madam Chair, with your permission, I'm going to ask that we hold questions until all the folks from this subcommittee have made a presentation. Is that all right?
I think so, and I think this would be a good time to talk about what this meeting is for, and that is to report out on the work that's been happening, because this is the last time that our work group will meet before the bill that's presented moves down into committee. Now, to be perfectly clear, that doesn't mean that this won't be changed, because it will go through an open and public committee process, as it should. But I want to thank not only the people at this table, but many of the people that are sitting in the audience for taking their personal time. The work that's done in our subcommittee groups is pretty intense, and we ask a lot of the people who weigh in, and we've gotten some great feedback, and we tried to incorporate that. So again, this is the last time this work group will be reporting out. We'll be meeting until, you know, potentially after the legislative session, but this will then go into a formal committee process. Also, this particular meeting is for reporting out what has happened up until now, as opposed to discussing or making changes. There will be opportunity for that, but that's not what this is about. What we do want people to share, you know, how they, what the process was, what the product is, potentially concerns they might have, and then we'll work on that going forward in the committee, whatever committee this bill goes to, and I don't know which committee that is yet.
We'll know shortly in February.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
It'll be a members bill, not a committee bill. Do you know?
A members bill and not a committee bill?
What is a committee bill?
Oh, we have no idea. I don't know.
I think it's a
member bill. It's a member bill.
Okay. I'm just checking.
Thank you for checking, Senator. Now, Judge Burton, would you go next on this subject?
Sure. So First, I have to make the disclaimer that I am not here as an official representative of the Judicial Department. I am here offering my personal opinions. I will say that my personal opinions are formed by almost 15 years of hearing guardianship and conservatorship cases, many of which involve financial abuse, as well as running into financial abuse of elders in my criminal docket and my civil docket. I want to thank very much the legislative members of this work group and all of the members of the work group for allowing me an opportunity to provide input into this process. And I believe that the work group has also made a really good effort to reach out to many, many interested parties and receive input, and I really appreciate that. Since we're talking about what we've done and not necessarily everything that needs to be fixed, I will say that we've been working up to the wire on this proposed bill on power of attorney. There are still some things that need tweaking and can be improved, and that is raised by some of the comments that people have submitted. So I won't go into those. I think we can get those things done and make parts of it better. For me, the key things are formalities of execution that we're trying to impress both upon the person who's executing the power of attorney and the person who's witnessing it, that this is an important legal document, just like a will is or just like an advance directive is. Nothing in this bill, nobody thinks that anything in this bill is the absolute cure-all for financial abuse from powers of attorney. We're looking at incremental, can we do things that we hope will make some small improvements. We're looking at imposing a record-keeping requirement. Obviously, if things do go awry, if you can find records of where the money went, you're a lot better able to deal with what happened there. We're looking at making it express that an agent that abuses the power of attorney is going to be liable for that. Again, not a perfect cure. Oftentimes, the money will be spent and it won't be recoverable, but in some instances, perhaps it will be. And we're looking at allowing some court intervention. And that particularly, I don't know how my department will feel about that. My personal view is we may get some new cases in terms of this construing the power of attorney, but we may be able to avoid some guardianships and conservatorships. One of the concerns that's been expressed about powers of attorney is, on the one hand, you have the abuse side, and on the other hand, you have the good powers of attorney, the properly executed, and then those folks have difficulty having third parties recognize them because there are so many that are a product of abuse. And so there would be a process to allow a court to say, yes, that's a valid power of attorney, it's good. I did make some suggestions in terms of process on that we borrow heavily from guardianship and conservatorship and make it sort of a notice of time to object, notice by mail, 15 days, rather than a personal service of summons and 30 days to file an appearance, so that it's a little bit more of an expedited process and hopefully not that expensive. So again, I appreciate so much the work group's interest in this issue, and I'm happy to continue providing any input that would be helpful.
Thank you, Judge. And we may have a couple of questions, but we're going to move on now. I thank, again, as Representative Hoyle already mentioned, everybody for their input. An example of folks who have been quite faithful are our representatives from the credit unions and the banks, and particularly Betsy Steinberg. We're glad you're here, and I look forward to hearing from you on this subject.
Okay, thank you. Well, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to serve on the subcommittee on preventing financial exploitation. That's something very near and dear to my heart. And I want to thank both Representative Hoyle and Representative Gilliam for your leadership. You've done a great job with the subcommittee, and I appreciate that. We've mentioned in previous meetings that the banking industry has been very proactive in terms of finding steps in which we can prevent financial abuse, and especially with the Oregon Bankers Association and their educational materials that they've provided to our industry. I think, as has been mentioned, modifying the power of attorneys, as we found in our subgroup, is a very complex task and large. And what this committee has done, I think, especially with Fred's efforts, is to try to scale things back to something that we can actually handle and make a difference. And so, again, the Oregon Bankers Legal Council and the other bankers have not had a chance to review the work that this committee's done, but Kevin Christensen and I have been very active on this, and we really appreciate, you know, the the more modest approach that we've taken in terms of this direction. So again, thank you. From our perspective, from draft two, some of the provisions in the second draft were really not beneficial. They looked like they may be on paper, but they really weren't. And there were two sections we found very kind of problematic. The first section was section three regarding co-agents. It was removed, but in essence, that provided that co-agents could exercise authority independently unless the power of attorney provided otherwise. And removing this language from an end user perspective is very, very helpful. The people that review these materials are frontline staff. They're tellers, they're new accounts, they're not attorneys, they're not trained paralegals. What you're, in essence, if you make it too complex, they're being asked to make a legal opinion or legal judgment that they really don't have the wherewithal, you know, to make a determination whether that agent can act independently or alone. So leaving it alone, several banks tend to err on the side of making both co-agents act together and when in doubt. So again, thank you for removing that language. That's extremely helpful. I will say I have 30 years of experience reviewing these type of documents on the front, you know, the frontline staff bring them to me. There have been some power of attorneys I've had to call the attorney on because I'm not clear, and I've got a lot of experience under my belt. The other section that was problematic for not only for the bankers, but I think for several, was section 10 of the second draft, which outlined reasons a person may refuse to accept a power of attorney. That on the face looked like a really good idea. There were, you know, in statute you're going to outline the reasons to reject it. I know people in my industry, we tend to look at those lists and say, this is an inclusive list. We're going to draft that as to policy. If it doesn't fall on that list, it's not relevant. And so it actually would be counterproductive to its original intent. And so, again, thank you for deleting that from the second draft. Just a few comments going forward. You know, the perspective that I bring to this committee is the end user. And, you know, at banks in general and credit unions, we work very, very hard to protect our customers, young and old alike, not just the elderly, but everybody. And we're trained to detect and prevent fraud of all sorts. And the best tool we have for that is our experience. And so, again, when crafting legislation, you know, we'd like to be able to retain our ability to make judgment or you know, exercise our own judgment. So if you draft too much in a bill where we that gets taken away, like making a list that we have to adhere to, it's actually counterproductive. And then the other comment I have in terms of moving forward is keep the end user in mind. What looks and sounds good on paper isn't always the case. And I can tell you from firsthand experience with other legislation, if the power of attorney bill becomes too complex, too burdensome, or too much liability, financial institutions will probably stop accepting them. And, you know, that's unfortunate. So, again, I think what we've done in terms from revision draft two to draft three, great progress. And we'd like to see it continue. We're happy to participate in any further refining of the bill and look forward to our continued participation on the subcommittee. So, again,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Betsy. Senator Roblin, you may have noticed that she used the terms modest but important. I felt that was a great way to summarize this section of something this important. It should be modest and important. And those are words no one's ever used to describe me. I wanted to say that
important
before you.
Right. So.
They might have in Washington. I wasn't there.
Yeah, that's fine. That would be enough. Other discussion on this?
So I think we have a number of formal members of the group and the committees and subcommittees, but we have other people who have taken a lot of personal time away from their businesses, have come in and given us their opinions, and have really transformed what we would have put forward because, I mean, like the banks and the credit unions have said from our personal experience, this may seem like a good idea, but in reality, this would not work well. One of those people was Stephen Heinrich, also Sylvia Sycamore. But Stephen, do you have anything that you would like to comment on?
Yes, thank you.
Because, again, you were a really big part of getting this to where it is, and we anticipate that we'll be working with you on the drafts as they move forward.
I appreciate that.
The first thing I'd like to do...
So just identify yourself for the record.
I'm Steve Heinrich. I'm a lawyer in Corvallis. I'm going to get to my qualifications in just a second, but the first thing I want to do is second everything Betsy said. This is... I have been involved with a variety of pieces of legislation for at least the past 15 years, and I have to say that this is far and away the best process I've ever been a part of. We were involved early, we were invited in, and our perspective has been considered, which is, it should not be unusual, but it almost is, and I really do appreciate this. This has allowed a far better product than would otherwise have been. That said, this is not ready yet to be advanced. I'm an elder law attorney and a family law attorney. I do almost exclusively that, plus the real estate and a few other things that come along with that. But this is what I do. I do human problems, cradle to grave. I'm a former chair of the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm speaking on my own. I'm not speaking for the bar or for the section, but this is just by way of giving a brief introduction to my background. I'm afraid that the bill as it now stands, while tremendously improved from work draft 2, still has, as Betsy would say, unintended consequences that I'm not sure how we can fix, and maybe somebody else can figure it out, but we need more time to sit around and actually exchange ideas before this is advanced to try to figure these things out. As an example, and this is one that Sylvia Sycamore raised, and she can't be here today because she's in trial. Sylvia has a case where the alleged abuser has wormed their way into the household and is the nominal caregiver. This person does not need to be able to get reports from the attorney in fact so that he can find out how better to abuse the elder. As Sylvie's also pointed out, powers of attorney are not just for elders. They're for individuals who are buying a house, who can't be in town, whose husband is buying the house. They're for people who are climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. They're for people who are selling a car on consignment. And you would be astonished the number of people who come to me with a major concern being that they have a sibling or a child who is either drug addicted, gambling addicted, or just plain bad. They do not want these people to have any information about their affairs. Oftentimes I do what's called a nomination of guardianship and conservatorship, precisely so that these bad people won't be considered by the court to become a fiduciary for the person. The bill as it now stands would allow these people to require information from the, it's called agent in here, I still think of it as attorney, in fact I'll use either name interchangeably. And I think that that's something that really needs to be considered. I agree that this is a problem, as Fred Steele's pointed out, almost 400 cases over 2 years. Now, I was doing the math as I was sitting there, so maybe I've misplaced a decimal, but I think that means one per 100,000 in Oregon. So it's a problem, but it's not the same problem that purse snatching is. We want to make sure that we don't create unintended problems. We want to make modest progress, but we want to make progress. We don't want to create problems. And something that was raised by Deputy District Attorney Bina Hahn at our last subgroup meeting was very important. She noted that people who live in gated communities have a false sense of security. The codes haven't been changed for 20 years. The stalkerish boyfriend still has the code. The person who was the dog walker 20 years ago still has the code. Basically, anybody can get into that community. And my fear is that if you have something that really, really looks good, because it's got two witnesses and a notary, people are going to accept those documents. The thing to remember is, if you've got a competent criminal, He can produce a credit card that looks just like the one in your wallet, except yours is in your wallet and his is in his hand. You also have to remember that a very high percentage of the genuine powers of attorney that are misused were not improperly obtained. They were given some years ago by somebody who truly believed that their child was responsible. And then their child turned out not to be responsible once there was nobody keeping an eye on him. Or the child became addicted, or what have you. I've seen businesses that have gone out of business because frustrated employees have embezzled from them. The boss had no idea anything was happening until they went out of business. So I think that things that give an indicia of reliability, when that indicia may not be appropriate, can actually be negative. And if you'll read the material I put out, you'll see I gave one personal story. My dad used to be a government teacher on Little Diomede, which is 2 miles from Big Diomede, which is Russian. The supply boat didn't come for 4 years in a row. Well, it came, but it offloaded his stuff in the wrong place. So he basically had to live on the native hunting economy. He went out walrus hunting with the locals. In those days, that was perfectly legal. And you can't sneak up on a herd of walrus. I mean, you can't sneak up on a single walrus, but you can sneak up on a herd because everybody thinks the other one's watching. Don't put the bankers in the position where they've got something that looks good and where somebody with less experience than Betsy says, oh, we got two signatures and a notary, must be good. And they give out somebody's life savings. Remember, we're talking the life savings here, and we're talking no judicial supervision whatsoever. Remember, when you borrow things from the probate code, you're borrowing things from something where there is judicial supervision and where there's an opportunity for interested people to tell the judge if they think that the thing was forged or is being misused. So I can't overemphasize that it is of unbelievable importance.
Stephen, I appreciate these constructive, and they are, criticisms. In the interest of time, I'm going to ask you to summarize your portion of this in about a minute, and we'll have to move on to the next section.
Okay, my point is that I have barely scratched the surface of some of the less important things here. This is not ready to move forward, and having been involved in legislation for years, I understand what happens when it goes on to the formal committee, and it's a ponderous process, and the changes that are made are often not the finest change that you might have been able to obtain in a situation where you had a dozen people sitting around a table exchanging ideas. It's ponderous, it's cumbersome, and it's not really suited to something that is so far from ready. This really is going to create problems. And one of the great problems that it's going to create is it's going to give a hammer to abusers to use against perfectly appropriate agents or attorneys, in fact, because they're going to be able to request information that they can use to further their abuse, and they're going to be able to sue the agent. If the agent uses the power of attorney, goes to the store, does grocery shopping for mom, and while they're at it, they buy themselves a soda pop, they've committed abuse. And they're going to be popped, and they're going to have to pay $10,000 in attorney fees for the other side. And that's wrong.
So, and one of the things I would say, Stephen, is if you talk to anyone that's worked with us on the other bills that we've done through this group, is within the committee process, we work as hard to do the outreach and include feedback specifically from people who have experience like you so that that doesn't happen. So this isn't a draft that will move forward as is. We will continue to do, I mean, we all of us take our jobs really seriously in chairing this committee. We know we're not the experts. We know you and other people are the experts. So we will continue to reach out till we get something that's right, because I'd rather do something, take more time, and I know you've taken a lot of time, take more time to get something that does the right thing and that moves the ball down the field, as opposed to doing something quickly and doing it poorly.
I do appreciate that, and I wouldn't be here today if I didn't believe that, because I would have just held my fire for the committee.
Right.
And so I do believe that, but I do think that this bill, it was so much change from version 2 to version 3, so many improvements were made, that I'm afraid that some people think that it is in a position to move forward, and it simply is not yet. It is still a bill that is going to harm elders and other people who are
attorneys. And I think that's a fair point, and we're not happy with it as it is, but we're moving it to the next phase in the process. Thank you for being here, and thanks for sharing.
I appreciate it.
Are there other comments from folks on the committee up at the dais? Please.
Hello, Lori Rowe from OSU Federal Credit Union. I'd just like to piggyback on Betsy's comments and also Judge Barton's, just to recognize the process itself and thank you for being so inclusive. I've learned a lot just opening my eyes through the many guests that attended our subcommittee process and really striving to work to that win-win. I know that as with the legal counsel on the bank side, the same for the credit unions, look forward to partnering, Fred, with you or any others on the refinements that we know need to happen at the technical level to get this right. And also, whatever changes do emerge, we do want to just ensure that with the timeline that is given for implementation, we also take into account advance time to train staff to whatever does emerge. So back to Betsy's points of it may look good on paper, how it gets implemented and how we ensure team members at that front line are then equipped to work with whatever the enhancements are is built into that, if at all possible. So it's been a great process and appreciate the opportunity to serve and looking forward to the next steps. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lori. We're, again, glad that credit unions were represented all the way through. Mm-hmm. Other comments?
Arnie.
Thank you. I will say that I appreciated the comments made by our other members because this work group has been uniquely different over the last 4 years than many of our other work groups, in the sense that the two people who see you as co-chairs have taken it very seriously in the process, the committee process, and they didn't let it go in the last session. They washed it all the way, and when people wanted to introduce stuff from outside, because there are people who see it as an opportunity to introduce something else to a bill, they were very clear that wasn't going to happen, and have taken charge. And if it is not ready, I have absolutely total belief that they, even in their own frustration, will not move something that isn't ready, because that's kind of what they've committed to. And it's also made the process work better in committees, because the committee chairs, wherever this gets, understand that this is going to be babied along the way by some people that really care about it. And I think that's really important. And nobody wants to get into the same situations that we've had in the past, where the unintended consequences were so much greater than the positive consequences. So we are need to look for those. We need to hear those criticisms, and then we need to figure out how to go forward. But I'm pleased with where we're at now, and I know that there's a lot of work left to do. And it may be that the bill looks like it only takes part of what this whole thing has and says we can only work on this part right now. We haven't got the other stuff. So I have full confidence that we'll get there. So.
Thank you, Senator. Others? All right, with that now, I want to make sure Jeff's on the phone. Jeff, are you there? Jeff Aitken?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. So with that, we're going to close the update from the financial exploitation and move to the next update, and it's the Subcommittee on Quality of Care. And you'll see in front of you the draft LC 1155. Jeff, take it away.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. I'm Jeff Aitken from the Oregon Department of Human Services. Speaking on behalf of the Quality of Care subgroup, what we decided to do is focus on the employees providing care, the long-term care employees. As you all know, we've talked about this over the last couple of updates as well. Providers of care, the long-term care community, are subject to background checks. And today, those are, I like to think of them as passive, or I'm sorry, active background checks, where we're actually going out every 2 years on average to check their criminal history, abuse history, and assess the risk in order for them to be able to provide care. In order to help improve that, a few years ago, the department applied for a grant from CMS, who awarded the grant, and to put in place a system called RAPBAC. And And what this would do is with any for providers of long-term care, it would be subject to a national fingerprint-based background check in which we're checking a national criminal history and then Oregon abuse histories. But we were going to actually receive feedback from the Oregon State Police when new arrest activity occurs. So this will ease some administrative burdens and that we won't have to do rechecks on regular basis because we'll have this passive, continuous evaluation of an individual's criminal record out there. Now, what we did with the legislative concept, LC 1155, you have in front of you, is we had four things that we really wanted to accomplish. The first thing was to allow for the development of the RAPAC system. For that system, there will be some cost of the grant received from CMS. The intent of that grant is to pay for that development. So very excited about that. The second thing we wanted to do was allow for the retention of fingerprints. In order to have a RAPAC system, it's a fingerprint-based piece, so the Oregon State Police would need to retain the fingerprint of the applicant, the second piece accomplished. The third piece was the Oregon State Police serve all state agencies. So rather than just making a system specific for long-term care, the system developed will be available for use to all state agencies. The third thing we wanted to do, excuse me, was make it voluntary for agencies to subscribe to RAPAC. So if another state agency did not want to retain the fingerprints of their individuals and have the continuous evaluation, they wouldn't be mandated to. The final thing is we wanted to make it voluntary for the individuals. So if an individual does not want their fingerprints retained, they don't have to. They can still get a job, provide care. The backside to that is that anytime there's a change in their employment status, there'll be a new background check. And then they'll be subject to the recheck on an every other year basis. Section one of the bill really spells out the first two pieces, the RAPAC system and the retention of fingerprints, and then the remaining sections, two through eight, kind of hit all the existing enabling legislation to make sure it's the state police that will be retaining the fingerprints, that will have effective privacy protections in place, and that we won't be using these fingerprints for any purposes other than for the continuous evaluation due to their employment. This is a project that we've actually been working on since the formation of this work group a few years ago, and so we're very excited to have an LC to move forward with it. That's my update. If there's any questions or comments, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Questions or comments for Jeff?
Awesome. That sounds like I nailed it.
You're welcome. Becky, you're welcome if you'd like to.
Sure.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to chime in. We have been working with Representative Hoyle's office, with DHS, so with several members of the Elder Abuse Task Force on this concept. We do not have a position at this point. I think that there are several things that potentially could get us to a neutral, assuming that we can put in place some strong privacy policies. But that said, we continue to be very concerned about a program that allows for the government through these employee-based checks. So we're talking about innocent people, not criminal fingerprint checks, to retain biometric information about Oregonians. So that's the core of our concern. I am aware that there are some federal mandates around this issue, so we have a lot of work to do as an organization to figure out where we can strike the balance, and that is work that I'm committed to doing before session so we can make sure that we can balance as much as possible the competing interests here. So thank you for involving me.
And I want to thank you for being a part of it, and I know that this is a particularly difficult issue to balance between the civil liberties and, you know, what the federal law is, what we're doing, protecting people. And what I most appreciate is that even if we're not always on the same page, that you've come in with an open mind and you've been straightforward and worked really hard to try and figure out how to get the best bill possible, and I just want to say thank you.
Likewise. Thank you, Chair Hoyle.
Thanks, Becky.
Representative Hoyle, I'd like to echo that thanks as well. So thank you very much, Becky. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jeff.
So we'll close that update on the quality of care, and we'll move on to elder abuse reporting and wrongful takings. And Helen, there she is.
Of course, Bill.
What a team. Identify for the record, and we're glad you're here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Hoyle and members of the work group. My name is Helen Hirschbiel, and I'm the General Counsel for the Oregon State Bar. And I, like others, want to thank you all for your hard work on this very important topic, and also for being so inclusive in your discussions about the topic, including so many people, including the bar, and welcoming our comments. I want you to know that the bar does strongly support the legislature's decision to include lawyers as mandatory reporters of elder abuse. And in fact, we have been gearing up for January 1st, 2015, when lawyers will join the ranks of others to be mandatory reporters of elder abuse. A couple of the things that we've been doing, we've already had one presentation to lawyers on their reporting obligations. Amber Hollister, who's our Deputy General Counsel, presented with Ellen Clem. Thank you very much. And Amber Hollister is actually here in Salem today presenting on elder abuse reporting, and will be here again tomorrow presenting to the Marion County District Attorney's Office. We've also are drafting an article to be published in the January 2015 Bar Bulletin, and I want to thank specifically Chair Gilliam and Chair Hoyle for providing quotes for that article, and that will be on the topic of lawyers' obligation to report elder abuse. So the bar is very supportive of this. One of the things that I do in my role as general counsel is to provide training to lawyers on their mandatory reporting obligations. And I have done that in the child abuse reporting context for many years, and I've provided dozens and dozens of presentations on lawyers' obligation to report child abuse. And what I've noticed in those presentations is that lawyers who have no familiarity whatsoever with the topic often struggle to understand what really is child abuse and what are their reporting obligations. And so my goal here today is to encourage the work group to adopt a definition of abuse that is clear. My goal is clarity. I think clarity serves both lawyers and, frankly, all mandatory reporters of elder abuse, and it serves the purpose of the statute because it encourages reporting rather than discouraging reporting by having vague definitions. In particular, what I'm talking about is the definition of financial exploitation, which is defined currently as a wrongful taking of property of the elder. And wrongful taking has been defined somewhat by the court in Church v. Woods in the tort context, but it's unclear whether that applies in the reporting context and whether it should apply, frankly, in the reporting context. Again, my goal and my hope and what I'd like to encourage the work group today to do is to adopt a definition, particularly of financial exploitation. We've been talking about the possibility of incorporating the holding in Church v. Woods and the definition adopted by the court in Church v. Woods as the definition for financial exploitation. We haven't fully discuss that. We haven't brought that to others' attention yet, and we want to obviously get comment on that possibility because we really do want to achieve the best definition possible. So thank you again for inviting me to be here. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions at all? You know, I appreciate what you said about definitions. One of the things that was difficult for me to understand, I'm sure the senators and my co-chair knew more about this than I did when I got here. Definitions are very difficult, and they're very important. So thank you for that encouragement. I think it's probably clear to everybody that this particular section is not as well-defined, and it probably won't be a substantive part of our report that we adopt today. But the issues you're bringing up are extremely important as we go forward, both in committee as we discuss the two drafts, and hopefully this committee, this task force moving ahead. So those are good encouragements, and I am not taking lightly your admonition to get some definitions.
Thank you.
Any other comments or? Please identify.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam and Hoyle and committee members. My name is Hunter Emmerich. I'm a practicing attorney here in Salem, Oregon. My office is just down the street here. I've briefly spoken with the subcommittee before, and so I'll keep my comments very short. As Judge Burton knows, I do some of this work, not largely. It's not a huge part of my practice in terms of representing elders or trustees, but I do that enough so that when the reporting requirement came through, it caused me some concern about the definition, as Representative Gilliam said. And I just want to give you two quick real-life scenarios from my practice in terms of whether or not this is a wrongful taking, because at the end of the day, that's what the statute provides us in terms of definition is wrongful taking. Clearly, there are some things that are wrongful taking, but it's the ones that are on the fringes that are a little troubling for reporting examples. So I've got an elderly gentleman who's got a much younger girlfriend. And the kids are not happy about this at all. They're concerned that the younger girlfriend will be taking their inheritance from them. That's my client's concern. They would put it, I want to make sure that dad has funds available for his ongoing continued support and maintenance. So when the elder is saying no, I'm giving things to this younger person because I love and cherish her. She's supporting me and assisting me. Is that a wrongful taking? Right now, the statute doesn't help us. If he's competent, probably not. If he's maybe not so competent and we've got an undue influence, maybe. But if you're an attorney that isn't receiving this information through client confidences, for instance, you're on the other side, you pick up the phone and call and say, I've got a wrongful taking going on here. We've got financial exploitation. And there really aren't any standards to divide that one up. Another real life example that I've struggled with right now, and it's in litigation, is I've got a client that runs a multifamily operation. They have a number of spaces and units that they rent. They rent to all stripes and manners of people, including young people and old people. It's not a, you know, over 55 park. They got sued because they improperly, allegedly allocated electrical charges amongst 158 units, okay? If there's a violation, I don't think there is, but if there is a violation, it's a technical violation on how you allocate electrical charges amongst 158 people. Some of those people happen to be over 65, and so their attorneys brought a wrongful taking claim. Because if you look to Church v. Woods, Church v. Woods speaks to the idea that statutory violation can itself be a wrongful taking. And so whether or not that is or is not a wrongful taking, it's there. You have some people that are allegedly injured by the same conduct, but elders, because they're injured and it's a wrongful taking, arguably, get treble damages, get attorney's fees. And so again, we have an issue about whether or not a statutory violation is wrongful taking that somebody ought to be picking up the phone and making a report on. I just want to give you those two real examples, real life examples. I've got more, but I know you got other things on your table. The problem with Church v. Woods is the definition of wrongful taking is really not a central part of the case, and so that's a concern about whether or not that language that they do define wrongful taking really is dicta and binding precedent for all of us. That's the problem we've got.
All right, thank you, Hunter, and it sort of goes back, your presentation goes back to my co-chair's point. We need folks who can come in and take the time, I know you're close by and we appreciate that,
sure,
to tell us what it's really like where rubber meets the road. So I appreciate this insight, and we shall continue to take it under consideration as we move forward. We're going to have a report, unless there are other questions for this panel here. One quick thing, Helen, you mentioned the Oregon State Bar publication. I'm just curious who will be quoted first in the article. We can talk about that later. All right. Yeah, that's a more critical question.
Age before beauty.
Yeah. So all right, Jana. We would love to hear from you an overdraft, an overview of, not overdraft, I'm speaking of my own personal banking problems, of the draft report.
Okay, certainly, co-chairs and members of the committee, you have in your packet the 2015 draft report to the Legislative Assembly. It is a draft document, so please get out your red pens and edit it and let me know what needs to be fixed, modified, removed, added, changed, what other words you can come up with to describe that. So a brief summary. First page has a summary of the problem of elder abuse. It takes statistics from the OWAPI report specifically for Oregon and incorporates them. It looks at the history of this work group and prior legislation that it's brought forth. And it talks a little bit about the strategy with our three subcommittees and efforts in those specific three areas, and then coming back to the full work group. We then move into the recommended legislation. These are the LCs that we have that seem to have some support to them. I'm not sure I would go so far to say that they are fully 100% supported. But these are the ones that have moved forward out of the subcommittees. The first one is LC 999, which fixes the definition of sexual abuse. We move on to LC 1155, which is the fingerprint retention and ratback system. LC 1185, this is a special search warrant. Detective Smith, who couldn't be here today, came in and described a situation in which he's unable to get a search warrant for certain financial exploitation cases because they can't find out where the defendant is, and they're not really sure where the money's being taken from. So we got a small work group together who came up with a really terrific measure that seems to make everyone really happy. LC 2765 is modeled on Washington's bank freeze statute. We haven't received this one back yet from LC, so I can't tell you too many details about it because I haven't seen it. But it would allow a freeze on transactions or on accounts for up to 10 business days when there's suspected financial abuse. LC 2808 is the powers of attorney bill that you have here, or concept, I should say. And then we move on to recommendations on other concepts. Sometimes we have outside groups who come in with bills. One of these is LC 783, which is from the Department of Justice, and it allows the estate of a victim to seek restitution, even if the victim is deceased, which is not currently the case. So we make a recommendation on that. The Subcommittee on Financial Exploitation heard about this bill and put its stamp on there. And then we have a section on ongoing discussion. These are the issues that we talked about that we didn't resolve, that we identified as in the future, we would like to look at these some more. These include an assessment tool for abuse and investigations, looking into adverse events, maybe a parallel track for reporting adverse events, law enforcement training, working with notaries and providing more education on financial abuse, a potential registry for powers of attorneys, and mandatory reporting. So those are topics that we might take into the future, and I felt it was important to put them out that we had worked on them, we had discussed them, we're not making recommendations on them at this time.
Thank you, Janet. Now, when we talk about modifications before we move forward, was that last section regarding modifications, or am I misunderstanding that?
The last section was on mandatory reporters.
I'm sorry. I meant the heading of recommendations for ongoing discussion. That's different than the modification, the possible modification portion of our.
Yes.
Okay. Is it going to be worth mentioning in the report the definition issue that Helen brought up? And how would that be part of the modification process?
Chair Gilliam, I could see that as a helpful addition. I'm not sure that we have a proposed solution, which is one reason I have left that out for the moment. But if you would like me to put the problem in, I'm happy to do that.
So
I'm just suggesting it. I'm open to.
Yeah, so what I would like to do is move to adopt the 2015 report to the Legislative Assembly. Are there modifications that you would recommend that we add to that approval, that adoption?
Well,
go ahead.
The only one is if we go on the idea about a better definition, under the recommendations for ongoing discussion, it should be there. At least it's a big issue. The reality about definitions is if we don't come up with one, the courts will eventually, and some people will be harmed in that process because that's just what courts do. I mean, it'll come up, and they'll have to make a decision, and the gray will get less wide, and some people inadvertently will be caught up in that, and it will cost a lot of money for certain people. But the reality is the definition will eventually get honed, and I agree that it would be better to have that conversation and do it here the better you can, because in the long run, we might not like the definition that the courts come up with. They will come up with it based on the facts in individual cases that kind of narrow it. And I think it's a really important one. You know, they in child abuse and so on, as a school person, they kind of did away with it by saying, if you think, feel, and that when you do it, you can report it. It's not going to come back on you. Mm-hmm. And then let the other people who have more understanding do the investigation, decide. You aren't the decider. You're just the pointed out, and I think that's worked reasonably well, but it's still really difficult. I mean, every one of those conversations and decisions that a teacher or whatever or another mandatory reporter makes, it's a heartfelt decision. It became easier for a principal to decide that's their job. Let's just, if I have any doubts, go for it. But it is a difficult one, and I hope we can come up with a better definition. But I think it should be in that at least covered in the recommendations for ongoing discussion.
So, Co-Chair Gilliam, I move to adopt the 2015 report to the Legislative Assembly with the following modification, that we have an ongoing discussion about definitions.
Well, first I need to open a work session on the draft report. But I'm going to do that now because I think you're ready.
I am.
So I open a work session on the draft report to the Legislative Assembly.
Just once.
Thank you. My co-chair has made a motion to adopt the report as you see it in front of you. Is there any discussion?
With the modification.
And do we have enough clarity on the modification regarding definitions?
Mm-hmm.
Good. So did your motion include modifications?
Yes, it did.
Oh, I knew it would. So, without any further discussion, seeing none, then Christy, as you know, only the members of the actual task force, even though I wish everybody here would vote because it'll probably be unanimous, I don't know. Only the members can vote, and I'll ask you to call the roll.
Mr. Aiken. Excused.
Ms. Lassie?
Excused.
Mr. Brandon?
Yes.
Mr. Cohen?
Is Mr. Cohen there? Excused.
Mr. Greenland?
Aye.
Ms. Yeager?
Aye.
Ms. Johnson?
Aye.
Ms. Glenn?
Aye.
John Lamborn?
I'll assume excused.
Ms. Rowe?
Aye.
Mr. Simmons?
Aye.
Mr. Smith?
The detective is excused.
Mr. Steele?
Aye.
Ms. Steinberg?
Aye.
Mr. Young?
Excused.
Senator Milk?
Aye.
Senator Roblin?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
So with that, the motion carries and the report as modified is adopted. So you've already mentioned this is our last meeting, full meeting before session. We've got a job to do to keep everybody informed, and we shall do so. By that I mean the committee members and also individuals who have indicated their interest. You can do that today if you haven't done that already, and those individuals who have been working with us as volunteers as well. The LCs that we discussed will be introduced as bills. Again, there's a lot of discussion to go on, and there may be modification in this wonderful process we call the legislature. If the senator thinks the judicial branch has some difficulties, I would need to remind him of our own, but we've got work to do. And we will hopefully meet again in July. Any other comments before we adjourn? Seeing none, I thank you all.
Wait, a comment.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, I am Bertrand Kopp. I've been a senior advocate for 20 years. I've helped beat down a number of attempts to victimize the senior citizens by making small changes to the law. But the last sheet on the handout, you'll see example of what happens when something slips through. It's no longer legal for a person to defend themselves. And in spite of my objections, it sailed right through the legislation or signed off by the governor. No longer can people go to the state attorney general's office and get protection hostile proceedings by greedy last-minute relatives. The one thing I see wrong with Oregon's power of attorney law is it's durable. I've talked to national people, and they say more and more states are doing away with durable power of attorney because the person has to be conscious of what his agent is doing. And when I talk to the Legal Aid Society, they said, well, what you had to do with those old people is get a power of attorney over them, and then you can claim they're incompetent and do whatever you want. Well, that's not what I want. I want durable, non-durable powers of attorney for that reason, because it's being abused just by people saying, oh, don't worry about what she objects. She's incompetent. The handout I've given you has a number of points that I'd like to see you consider. I know I can know the amount of time available. I can't go over them point by point. But the statement was made about arguing about misapplication of funds. I'll point out that ORS 163.200, which I helped write, contains a statement about misusing anybody's property in any way. And the penalty is 3 years in prison. There's nothing like a threat of 3 years in prison to get that money back. And I've seen it in the newspapers where it's been used. And it's now a crime. Since Claire Hassenfuss was left at the dog racetrack up in Idaho, this measure was put in by the Clackamas County SSD that while it was mandatory to report elder abuse, it was not against the law. Well, that ORS 163.200 is a result of it to fix that. I put in the parts about financial abuse, physical abuse, and they only had abandonment in there. But a number of people found out to their displeasure that that law has teeth in it. But nevertheless, I urge you to consider that business in there where the judiciary department sneaked in some provisions that wouldn't let people get away with business as usual, and I'd like to see that deleted. I guess that's about all I can come up with. I'm sure your meeting time has run out. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and we'll look at this and keep this in mind as we move forward and the bill moves forward. And thanks for your work.
With that, we are adjourned. With that, we are adjourned.